From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, faith-based blockbusters. We'll talk about the making and marketing of the Christian hit Fireproof, which landed an impressive fourth place at the box office in its first weekend out. Plus, after 90 years of making the stars look fabulous, the first family of hair and makeup finally gets its own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from KCRW. There's been a new hand dealt in the ongoing poker game between the producers and the Screen Actors Guild. With no SAG contract signed and a work stoppage even remotely possible, production has been light. But now, Variety reports the studios are going all in, with hundreds of millions of dollars to start making movies again next spring and summer. Of course, the announcement could just be the producers calling SAG's bluff. The Guild threatened to take a strike vote week before last as they struggle for some leverage in their non-negotiations with producers. No matter how all this plays out, at the end of the day, it's pretty clear who'll take the pot. Nobody. Elsewhere, the Academy Board of Governors voted last week to end its 55-year ban on movie ads during the Oscar telecast. A limited number of slots will be made available, but restrictions do apply. Advertised movies can't open until weeks after the show, and ads can't mention the Oscars in any way. There will also be a restriction on ads for sequels or prequels to films nominated in the current year. The Academy ban on ads for movies has been in place since the Oscars were first televised in 1953 in an effort to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest. But that clearly has gone out the window since audiences for the Oscar broadcast have been dropping, and so one might expect have ad revenues. Limiting the number of spots might be seen as restraint or as a move to keep supply low and therefore prices for ads high. Finally, box office went to the dogs last weekend in a good way. Beverly Hills Chihuahua neither sat nor stayed, but brought in a surprising $29 million. Box office in general was looking good. The gross for the top 12 movies was up 42% from the same weekend a year ago. Well, they do say that in tough economic times, people love to escape with a movie. Oddly, the stock price of video rental giant Netflix dropped painfully as the company ended its third quarter with fewer subscribers than expected and lowered its outlook for the fourth quarter. Our theory? Home entertainment thrives only when people have homes. With so many foreclosures, Americans may not be going to the movies as much as living in the theater. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, praise the Lord and pass the popcorn. The new film Fireproof took fourth in the box office derby in its opening weekend, bringing in almost $7 million. That may not seem like a lot, but it's an impressive number when you consider it opened on only 839 screens. The number one movie that weekend, Eagle Eye, opened on 3,500 screens. And while Eagle Eye brought in five times as much as Fireproof, it cost 170 times as much to make. Not to mention that Eagle Eye won't help save your marriage or your soul. In what must be the ultimate Hollywood hyphenate, Fireproof was made by two writer-director Christian pastors. It's the story of a firefighter played by Growing Pains star Kirk Cameron, who, as he says in the film, is a hero to everyone but his wife.
You gotta beg God to teach you how to be a good husband. And don't just follow your heart. You gotta lead your heart.
Fireproof isn't the first time pastors Alex and Stephen Kendrick have had a hit Christian movie. Their 2006 story of an underdog football team called Facing the Giants was made on a shoestring budget but eventually earned more than $10 million. What's interesting is that where the studios have never understood the Christian market, the mainstream music labels have made big bucks singing the Lord's praises. Ironically, Provident Films, which was involved in the making and marketing of Facing the Giants and Fireproof, is a sister company not of Sony Pictures, but of the Provident Music Group, Sony's Christian music label. Studios are not just leaving Christian moviegoers money at the table, they're abandoning specialty films altogether. But they could learn something from the success of Fireproof about making movies for less, appealing to niche audiences, and marketing to them at the grassroots. The business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke with Chris Feuer and Michael Silberman, who partnered in the marketing and distribution of Facing the Giants and now Fireproof. Chris is Vice President of Marketing of faith-based Provident Films, and Michael is President of Distribution for mainstream indie company Samuel Goldwyn Films.
Chris Fuhrer, Michael Silberman, welcome to the business.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much.
How did the relationship between Provident, which is in Tennessee, and Samuel Goldwyn, which is in New York and L.A., come about? What were those discussions like? Chris, you want to take that?
We had found this movie, Facing the Giants, that was made by a church in Georgia, and we took it over to Sony and said, hey, we think this has got a lot of potential for theatrical release. And they actually brought Samuel Goldwyn into the equation, knowing that they had a lot of expertise in gently handling a film that was going to a specialized audience.
You know, in terms of being an independent film, I think that Fireproof really reaches all the criteria that Goldwyn looks for in an independent film. You know, it's a film that's made from the vision, writer, director. It's made on a small budget. It has no stars. It's truly an independent film. It's not like the independent films that we handle on a daily basis, but it's a very special film.
Now, Meyer Gottlieb, the president of Samuel Goldwyn, told ABC News recently, and as well as myself, I talked to him for an interview I did with him for Ad Age, that the evangelical audience just doesn't react well to advertising. As he put it to me, they don't believe that it's silk. You have to let them feel the fabric. Why not? Why not just buy advertising?
Well, I think the evangelical audience, they want to hear from one of their own, and they want to hear from people who they trust and have a relationship with. So that's folks that are within their circles of media and ministry. And I also think that over the past few years, Hollywood has brought a lot of films to the evangelical audience and said, trust us, you'll love this. And they haven't necessarily loved it. So they're kind of a little reticent now to just buy something at face value. They want to touch it and feel it and see it and experience it and know that it's authentic for them.
Give me an example of that disconnect where something was promised that just didn't pan out. And what was the disconnect, so to speak?
Well, you know, I think the expression people use in Hollywood is they unpack the parable. Mm-hmm. For instance, when the Polar Express came out, they took it out to the evangelical audience and say, hey, this is a movie about the power of believing in something. Well, it was a movie about Santa Claus. So, you know, that was an example of I think, making a stretch for the audience.
You mentioned these ministries. How important were they to marketing the film? How did you market the film, if not the usual way?
One of the things that we really try to do is make people feel a part of the process, whether they're a consumer, you know, out in Kansas, or they're the head of a ministry that's got several million people in its database. And we start at the very beginning. We invite them to the set so that they can come down to Albany, Georgia, and feel what it's like to be part of this church and part of this huge group of volunteers that get together to make a movie.
You also took a very specialized approach to its distribution. Talk a little bit about the pre-sale requirement about this, because this was, I think, one of the most interesting things about the success of the movie.
Well, Chris and her team really go out and they really market the film and reach out to audiences to try to get the pre-sales to opening weekend to be, you know, a spectacular number. And what's an important component to that is to get an early commitment from the theater owners to book the film and to list their show times, and then Chris and her team go out and spread the word and alert everybody that the tickets are on sale and to flock to the theaters to support the opening.
Now, Chris, you were kind of a tough guy about making sure that people committed to this movie. You kind of gave them an ultimatum, even in the smallest hamlets, right?
Right. You know, the thing about a movie is once you set opening weekend, and I tell my team this all the time, opening weekend is coming no matter what we do or don't do. And so once that date is set, we really work with the communities to push them to, you know, get their ticket commitments and to get people organized. And we've kind of got it down to a system now in terms of, you know, we lay out for these action squads, okay, this is what you need to do. You're going to need four people. You need one person who's in charge of ticket sales. You need one person who's organizing a screening. You need another person who's going to be your phone follow-up person. I mean, we really walk them through the process to help them see that, you know, while it looks like a big elephant, you can eat that elephant one bite at a time. And ultimately, it's very easy to get to 1,000 tickets once you can get people excited about the project.
Now, that number is not just something you grabbed out of the air. If you wanted a print of this movie, you had to commit to 1,000 tickets. Is that right?
Not everywhere. I mean, what we do, we sit down with Goldwyn, and through their knowledge of how theaters work and how they gross and, you know, where we might best place the film, as well as looking at where past faith-based films have performed and just our experience on our side of having been involved in a lot of faith-based films over the last 8 to 10 years, we lay out an initial release pattern. But then we also tell folks, hey, if you want to guarantee, if you don't want to leave it up to chance, if you want to guarantee that the movie's going to be there opening weekend so you can plan, you know, a big church event or a big ministry or community event around it, then get together and buy your 1,000 tickets, and that guarantees you that the opening, which is different. Most movies don't do that. You know, the movie kind of shows up at the multiplex and it's there. For us, we'll work with you to guarantee that it shows up.
Yeah, this is almost like off-Broadway previews in a way, that it has an advanced sale.
Absolutely.
The interesting thing about this, about the film in terms of the small markets, is that these markets are performing way above their normal market share that they do on a standard film. You know, not that they're really small towns, but by, you know, Hollywood standards, towns like Tyler, Texas, and Dothan, Alabama, and Columbus, Mississippi, these were all towns that, you know, normally don't perform on the high end of a commercial release. But with a film like Fireproof, they're above and beyond, you know, the norms. And, you know, when you're going on 870 prints as opposed to a 3,000 print release, you have to be very, very selective as to where you're placing the film.
That's what I want to touch on. I mean, Michael, you held something like 200 free screenings of the movie around the country to create sort of the buzz about it. Just put that in perspective for me. Is that 100 more, or, you know, 50 more, or no more than you would do for any other movie?
I mean, you know, with a typical art house release, you know, you're looking at maybe 35 to 50 screenings prior to your opening.
Mm-hmm. So this would be like four times that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, Claude Brodesser Ackner is speaking with Chris Fuhr and Michael Silberman, who partnered in the marketing and distribution of the Christian films Facing the Giants and now Fireproof. Both have done BAFO box office. Chris is vice president of marketing for faith-based Provident Films, and Michael is president of distribution for mainstream indie company Samuel Goldwyn Films.
I want to go back to Chris for a second here. I mean, you really considered the details here in a very almost military invasion style way, which is appropriate for someone who is, I guess, a former, you know, army captain in intelligence. But talk a little bit about sort of the fine-tuning of the release, because it seems like nothing was left to chance.
Well, you know, you get one shot to get it right. And so you really can't leave anything to chance. And you have to look at all the possible obstacles that will keep your consumer away from the theater. And, you know, we look at what do we have to do to overcome their objections? Well, one of the things that's important for churches is they want to plan way out. So we work very closely with Goldwyn to get the exhibitors to post their showtimes way out. You know, we ask, okay, what's going to keep a couple from going? Well, I've got kids, and, you know, people who have kids, it's really hard to go to the movies. And so we said, okay, babysitting is important. So we came up with a list of 10 different ways a church could provide babysitting so that couples could go see the movie. We invited firefighters, folks from the New York City Fire Department as well as the Los Angeles Fire Department came to the set, and folks that had contacts to chaplains and fire departments so that they could start spreading that word among fire department chaplains early. We just really want to make sure that all the different people that will contribute to opening weekend, that they are embraced early in the process, and that we maintain a continuous personal relationship with them, which is actually one of the most fun things about the release, is all the people across the country that we get to know during the course of the marketing of the movie.
Michael, I want to ask you, how was it actually booking the film in theaters? I mean, did they sort of react like, oh, great, another Christian movie. Let me get rid of The Dark Knight to make room for this.
To distribute a film effectively in the U.S., you really need the support of 4 to 5 major exhibition chains. And, you know, we visit those exhibitors. We place multiple phone calls, meetings with them. We fly on planes. Chris and I went to Kansas City. We went to Knoxville, Tennessee, and we sat with everybody. We explained our marketing plans. We explained how we were going to roll the film out. And, you know, we got great support because, you know, there's a past track record for us with Facing the Giants, and there's a success story there. Now, the outreach to the ministers, to the pastors, I mean, that's the key component to bringing in the audience. And I think that all the exhibitors understood that with Provident working with us, you know, that there was a recipe for success that had already been brought to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I understand that you were successful in this movie and with the previous iteration from Alex Kendrick, Facing the Giants. But let me ask you the tough, nasty question here, which is there a business in this? Can this be done? I mean, you can't have an Obama campaign every day of the year. It can't be grassroots all the time. People can't be asked to volunteer on a movie at all times. How many of these can you do a year? How long can you keep this up? And how often can you do this?
You know, I think we could do this successfully twice a year.
But, I mean, how much support can there be really in this marketplace? Like, how many movies do you think evangelical Christians would go see in a year if there was someone there to make them for them?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question, because one of the things that we find in our market research that we do during our test screenings is that folks just, these are folks that just don't go to the movies hardly at all. And so it is a good question. It is new ground as to how much product they'd be willing to absorb a year. But I will say that I think that the partnership between Provident and Goldwyn is very unique, and folks would be hard-pressed to recreate what we do.
Well, in terms of getting sort of the Nashville and Heartland evangelical film world closer to Hollywood, let me ask you this, Chris. You hired a sort of Hollywood effects company to help you make the fire look real in Fireproof. Why have evangelical Christians been so reluctant to hire Hollywood to write them a script? I mean, everyone's a gun for hire out here. They'll write you anything you want.
A story of faith has to be organic to the story itself. You can't wire it in. You can't go to school and study it. You can't, read a book and then try to apply that to the screenplay. What makes these movies successful is that these are men of faith, and that they weave into these stories their experiences and their struggles with their own faith. Then you can't hire a screenwriter necessarily in Hollywood to write about his everyday struggles with his Christian faith.
Yeah, I don't doubt that it requires a certain authenticity. You can't sort of phone it in that you're evangelical and then, you know, you insert enough Jesuses into a script, but to at least use them to get the form, the structure, the dialogue, something a little cleaner, so to speak, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak to Sherwood and the Kendrick brothers. I'm not a filmmaker. But what I do know is that they must be doing something right in their storytelling, because you can't be the number four movie in the country if you aren't telling a great story.
I mean, the irony of being an evangelical Christian is that it seems, though, they're not evangelizing. That is, this could be a real vehicle to proselytize the faith and the values. And it seems like, for whatever reason, there's an unwillingness to employ it.
I think people are starting to make that transition to realize that, you know, we are facing a very visual generation. And if you want to win that generation, you're going to have to do it in a visual way. And I think the Kendricks are a little bit ahead of that curve. And it'll be interesting to see over the next 5 to 10 years how that plays out. You know, if people are able to, in fact, you know, grow this into a larger medium and grow it into a larger audience.
Chris, how do you and, of course, the makers of the movie measure success?
Well, we measure success by what we hear back from our audience. We look at just how many lives and people are being affected by this. I mean, obviously, it's a business, and we want to be good stewards of the money that we have, and we want to make sure that, you know, it's a profitable and enjoyable venture all the way around for all the partners involved. But it's also very important for us to know that the movie has made an impact on people and made an impact on the culture. And we get literally thousands and thousands of emails from people talking about how this has changed their lives, their marriage. And at the end of the day, you feel good when you're doing something that really has a positive impact on people's lives.
Michael, I imagine you measure success a little differently.
Absolutely not. Movies that, you know, disappoint audiences aren't successful. And this film is clearly working with audiences. And, you know, the box office is going to reflect that.
We got to leave it there. Chris Fuhr is Vice President of Marketing for Provident Films, which distributed the Christian films Facing the Giants and now Fireproof. Michael Silberman is Head of Distribution for Samuel Goldwyn Films, and he marketed and released Fireproof. My thanks to them both. They joined us by phone. Chris, Michael, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you, Claude.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Coming up after a short break, the legacy of a show business dynasty is finally cemented in Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. On October 3rd, a crowd gathered near Hollywood and Vine for a ceremony inaugurating the Westmore family into the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Ladies and gentlemen, we proudly welcome to the Walk of Fame, the Westmore.
As the first family of Hollywood hair and makeup, the four generations of Westmores literally changed the face of the business.
How many Westmores do we have out there? Raise your hands. You know, there are a lot of Westmores, I can say.
It all started when George Westmore left the Isle of Wight in 1909 with $35, four kids, and some big ideas about the tonsorial arts. After working in hair salons around the country, he finally arrived in Hollywood in 1917, and he found that the fledgling film industry had simply borrowed the mop-like wigs and excessive makeup of the stage, and George saw a niche for himself. He would go on to create Hollywood's first hair and makeup department at Triangle Studios, the home of the Keystone Cops and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. Today, many Westmores still ply their trade, but the makeup departments are gone, and so is the middle-class life of many Hollywood tradesmen. Producer Darby Maloney has more.
According to a memoir by his youngest son, Frank, George Westmore broke into the business when he talked the Selig Film Studio into paying him $25 a week to work on their famed jungle pictures. But grooming Jackie the Lion's mane grew old fast, so he leapt at the chance to make a wig for Billy Burke, who years later would glimmer as Glinda the Good Witch in The Wizard of Oz. By then, George's reputation as a wig master had gotten around, and everybody wanted one of his signature crocheted European-style hair lace wigs. But George Westmore didn't stop at hair. Marvin says that his grandfather also wanted to conquer makeup.
And who wore makeup in those days? Prostitutes. And so what he did is he traded hair services for makeup lessons. And that's how he learned how to do beauty makeup.
George Westmore hit the big time when he was hired to create the first hair and makeup department at Triangle Studios, home of the Keystone Cops and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. For the industry, this and the Selig Studio Department would help set the stage for the next phase of the business. And for George personally, this would begin his family's Hollywood dynasty. When George got started, the movie industry was as wide open as the orange groves that dominated Los Angeles. And jobs were readily available for go-getters like George Westmore and his six sons. Grandson Marvin tells the story.
Adolph Manjou, who had a very thin, pencil-like mustache, he accidentally shaved it.
George wasn't available, so one of his sons stepped in.
Purse grabbed the opportunity and on a piece of lace ventilated a duplicate to the other side.
As Hollywood grew, so did the prominence of George Westmore's six sons, Purse, Earn, Monty, Wally, Bud, and later Frank. In the era of the studio system, each studio functioned like a factory with departments for every facet of filmmaking, from sets to wardrobe to writing. The Westmores ran the studio's hair and makeup departments, which meant that they were the bosses of a team of hairstylists and makeup artists who worked on every single picture that a given studio made, regardless of genre or style. It was a model that benefited the studio's bottom line and gave workers a steady income.
In those days, you went to work for a studio and you stayed there for your life.
Michael Westmore is another of George's grandsons and a recently retired makeup artist.
You were part of the staff. Once you were accepted in there, you were a staff member and you were just moved from film to film to film.
During the heyday of the studio system, Hollywood functioned like any industry town. And as department heads, the Westmores were company power brokers. They controlled who got jobs and who entered the coveted studio apprenticeship programs, where everyone learned makeup in those days. This access made it easy for Marvin and his brothers to join the business. When they needed jobs, the reliable studio post was there. Grandson, Marvin.
I came out of this military service, married with one child, and working at a liquor store, and my older brother, my mother said, here's a makeup case, you're going to go work in the studios.
But the business was changing. When Marvin and his older brother, Monty Jr., went to work in the 1950s, the studio departments and apprenticeships still ran, but the studio system was all but dead. Plus, where there'd been a few master tradespeople, now there was an army of them. Older Westmores had cobbled together prosthetics with grapefruit peel and made blood with caro syrup and relied on their ingenuity. Now these techniques had been passed on, and new materials were widely available. So when the studio system finally disappeared, it was every production tradesperson and craftsman for himself.
Where in the old days, when you had a department, people were on salary. Now, there's no such thing as a makeup department in any studio anymore.
George's grandson, Michael Westmore, whose credits include Raging Bull, an Oscar for Mask, and a ton of Emmys, many for his 18 years on Star Trek, worked under the old system and the new.
There's a trailer parked outside, and depending on how big the actor is, depends on how big the trailer is, and there's a makeup setup in there, and they get made up. They go to the set. When the picture wraps, that trailer's sent back to the rental, and that makeup artist goes to another show.
Again, Marvin Westmore.
When the studio system died, the studios found out that for their financial benefit, they were better to rent their facilities to independent producers and directors to do their films than it was to try and maintain a whole, you know, a carpentry crew, an upholstery crew, a prop room, a wardrobe.
In this system, Hollywood tradespeople like the Westmores vie for jobs in an erratic freelance world where earning a steady paycheck is no guarantee. Before retiring, Marvin Westmore toiled in this world.
I've had as high as 14 employers in 1 year. And the average person, if they get an unemployed period, it's devastating. And that's just part of our lifestyle.
Kevin, Marvin's son and George's great-grandson, grew up on the sets with his dad and uncles, so he saw the old system. But when Kevin actually became a makeup artist in the 1980s, he was one of the first Westmores to never work in it.
It's a crazy business as it is. You're almost a carnival worker because you never know where your next job's coming from. So I'm calling everybody I know and going, hey, do you need me? You got to be a go-getter to stay up on the top to make a living at it.
Now, Kevin, who's in his 50s, is no slouch. He won a couple of Emmys for his work on The X-Files. But in this current system, talent only takes you so far. And while being a Westmore may be a source of pride, it's not a source of work.
Yes, the name Westmore meant a lot. Today, it doesn't open any doors or close any doors, but it doesn't really do anything anymore.
Marvin and others in the family lament that the focus in today's Hollywood undermines the art of the business that their family held dear.
It's a giant multinational business, and all they think about is the bottom line. They don't think quality.
And with the people at the top in Hollywood making so much money these days, the tradespeople are often getting squeezed out of the middle class figuratively, and with high Los Angeles real estate prices, out of town, literally. So why do working people continue to flock to Hollywood? Glamour is a big reason. But for Kevin Westmore, it's almost genetic.
You have to love this business, and it seems like it's been an inherited love.
And for his dad, Marvin, it's complicated. On the one hand, he runs the Westmore Academy, training people to be makeup artists. And yet, he sees today that the risk for failure in this business is staggering.
I wouldn't wish this on anybody, because you've got to just really want to do it. And if you don't really want to do it, you'll be a failure. And no one wants their kids to be failures.
For The Business, I'm Darby Maloney.
And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. Special thanks to Michael Germana of SuperstarImages.com for the use of audio from the Westmore's Walk of Fame ceremony. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can podcast the show, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com, and you can also podcast the show through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Matt Holzman, and we'll see you next week on The Business.